How dependent are the conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza on satellites, bomber guidance, and command and control warfighting functions based in space? How is privatization of space enabling more wars? Are there numerous parallels between the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and the October 7th attack on Israel 22 years later? Are there, in fact, numerous clear signals that the Hamas attack on Israel was a false flag operation? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we are observing key themes in 21st century warfare that are missed in conventional mainstream media coverage. In our first half hour, Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space reveals how space technology has transformed modern warfare and how today's peacemakers can fight back. And in our second half hour, the pivotal 9/11 truth activist Richard Gage steps in to tell listeners about the 21 parallels between the September 11th attack on America and the October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel, including the state reaction satisfying the nation's prior geostrategic goals. On this week's program, Wars of Today, Space Age Perils, Fraudulent Pretexts. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 4th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The settlers who came to this land in recent centuries secured access to natural resources through false promises, broken treaties, force, and the document of discovery, which cheated the indigenous people who were here first. In the spirit of partnership, we pledge to offer reparations for past wrongs and share the resources in a respectful way going forward so the harms of the past will no longer be repeated. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. In the words of Prime Minister Netanyahu, quote, "Iran made a big mistake tonight, and it will pay for it. The regime in Iran does not understand our determination to defend ourselves and to retaliate against our enemies," unquote. NYT emphasis added. Bear in mind, Israel is a de facto member of NATO, which serves the strategic interests of the U.S. That comes from the article, "Iran's operation, quote, true promise too, unquote, against Israel. Remember Dick Cheney, quote, let Israel do the dirty work for us, unquote," by Professor Michelle Chosudovsky, posted October 2nd. Netanyahu should know that Iran is not seeking war, but it will stand firmly against any threat. This is just a glimpse of our capabilities. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, followed the president's remarks by posting an illustration of a large underground weapons cache that would be used to deter future Israeli aggression. Less than an hour after the attack, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan delivered an ominous warning, saying, quote, "There will be severe consequences for this attack, and we will work with Israel to make that the case," unquote. That comes from the article, "Iran fires a warning shot across Israel's bow," by Mike Whitney, posted October 2nd, originally published on the UNS Review. Netanyahu has spent many years trying to draw the United States into a war with Iran and has kept escalating the Gaza crisis for a year at the cost of tens of thousands of innocent lives, with that goal clearly in mind. Biden has been out of his depth throughout this crisis, relying on political instincts from an era when acting tough and blindly supporting Israel were politically safe positions for American politicians. Secretary of State Antony Blinken rose to power through the National Security Council and as a Senate staffer, not as a diplomat, riding Biden's coattails into a senior position where he is as out of his depth as his boss. Meanwhile, pro-Iran militia groups in Iraq warn that if the U.S. joins in strikes on Iran, they will target U.S. bases in Iraq and the region. So we are careening toward a catastrophic war with Iran with no U.S. diplomatic leadership and only Trump and Harris waiting in the wings. That comes from the article, Biden's Israel Policy Has Led Us to the Brink of War on Iran, by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies, posted October 3rd. NATO's continued arms shipments to Ukraine next year are at risk due to a lack of resources among key backers of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, experts told Bloomberg on September 27th. This is a far cry from the promises made in the first years of the war when the West promised to support Ukraine until victory was achieved, a victory that will not occur. At stake is a controversial $50 billion loan deal, which came from the profits from the Russian central bank's frozen assets in Western banks. Bloomberg reported that Washington fears that Hungary could block or reduce the deal. Even if the amount were released, it would only be enough to keep the Kiev regime supplied with weapons until the middle of next year. That comes from the article, quote, Grand Failure of Biden's Adventure in Ukraine, unquote. Resources of Ukraine NATO allies, including military aid, will dwindle by 2025. By Ahmed Adel, posted October 3rd, originally published on InfoBricks. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. With the unprecedented war fighting taking place on the planet, we seldom think of the role of space and its critical role in these activities. We wanted to seek more information about these developments from a peace perspective. The Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space is an international network of organizations and individuals who are concerned about the militarization and exploitation of space. We got hold recently of Bruce Gagnon, Global Network's coordinator, to talk more about the various methods in play on the current dynamics of war.
I think one of the most important things is NATO expansion. You know, at the time of the collapse of the former Soviet Union, NATO, the United States, approached then President Mikhail Gorbachev of the Soviet Union and said that they wanted to reunite East and West Germany and would, now that the Soviet Union was dissolving, would Russia agree to that? And Gorbachev said, we would agree to it on one simple condition, that NATO not expand one inch towards Russia, to the east, towards Russia. And U.S. Secretary of State James Baker at the time and other NATO officials agreed to that. But then when Bill Clinton became president, he began what he called NATO enlargement, and began moving NATO towards Russia. And today it has expanded dramatically right up to the Russian borders. Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Finland, Sweden, Norway's in it, Romania, you know, many other countries. And they want Ukraine to be a part of it. They'd like to have Georgia as part of it. Really an encirclement, if you will, of that part of the Russian European border, if you will. And so this is a grave danger. And in all of these places, the United States has begun installing various space technology bases, both what are called downlink facilities, radars that talk to satellites that help target a first strike attack on Russia that the U.S. Space Command has been wargaming annually for many years. And in addition, in the case of Romania and Poland, the United States has built what they call Aegis Ashore launch bases, where they can fire first strike attack, Tomahawk cruise missiles, nuclear capable, and also they can fire after the first strike hits Russia and Russia tries to do a retaliatory strike at the same bases in Romania and Poland. They have these SM-3 interceptor missiles. So after you fire the SWORD, the Tomahawk cruise missile, nuclear capable at Russia, and then Russia tries to respond, they then have the SHIELD, these so-called missile defense systems that theoretically pick off Russian missiles, giving the US a quote unquote successful first strike attack. And so this is what's happening throughout Eastern Europe now, right up to the Russian border. And it's all hooked up to space. The Pentagon has long been saying that space technology directs every single thing that the US military does these days, no matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, you're on a boat in the Navy, in the ocean, or you're flying an airplane, or you're launching missiles. Everything the Pentagon does is coordinated and directed by space technology. And so the US and NATO have supplied Ukraine today with lots of various technologies, drones, missiles, other such things. And US AWACS planes and NATO AWACS planes are flying over the Black Sea, calling in the target coordinates inside of Russia and Crimea and other parts of Russia as Ukraine then launches these missiles towards these targets inside of Russia. Without the United States and NATO using their space technology capabilities, Ukraine would not have any ability to do that, to hit Russia whatsoever. And now they're talking about long-range missiles that can go far deeper inside of Russia, should NATO, US and NATO give those to Ukraine. And again, they would only be workable because of US space technology capabilities. Excuse me. Similarly, today in the Red Sea, the United States has deployed Navy Aegis destroyers made here in the mid-coast of Maine, where I live at Bath Iron Works, which is owned by General Dynamics. On board those ships, they have these same two technologies. They have first strike attack, nuclear capable Tomahawk cruise missiles, and they also have these SM-3 interceptors. So they've been operating since October in the Red Sea, trying to take out Houthi in Yemen, any strikes they launch toward Israel. And they've also been firing their cruise missiles and trying to take out Yemenis' military capabilities on the land. So these technologies are very, very active in war fronts today. At the same time, the US is now moving NATO into the Asia Pacific to try to encircle China. And they're deploying these same capabilities there. In fact, at Bath Iron Works right now, they're working on seven new Aegis destroyers that will be sent to encircle both Russia and China. So it's a really dangerous moment we're in. And again, space technology is directing the entire US offensive operation.
Israel, I mean, beyond going into Lebanon, now they were faced with an unprecedented attack or retaliatory attack by Iran.
about over 100 missiles that were fired into their territory. Do you see this becoming an expanded war, and what role will all of this technology have with the in that new front?
Well, actually, my reading of yesterday was that Iran launched several hundred missiles, and they primarily launched against two kinds of targets. One was Israeli Air Force bases where planes are sent to attack Lebanon, throughout Gaza, and Iran as well, previously. At the same time, they hit those, and apparently quite a few landed. But the United States and NATO, Germany, France, UK, Jordan, were assisting the attempts of Israel to shoot these missiles out of the sky. But I've seen many videos now, and it's pretty clear that quite a huge number of them landed on targets at these Israeli military bases. At the same time, Iran took out a couple oil platforms, these oil rig platforms owned by Israel, providing them with oil or gas, I'm not sure which. But they took out a couple of those, which is going to further bleed the already very constrained and constricting Israeli economy. So I think that Israel will be forced by its own public opinion to respond in some way. But Israel's biggest goal right now is to drag the United States and NATO into a full-blown war with Iran. But I think there's some reluctance on the part of the US and NATO to do that, to go full bore for war with Iran, because not because they're good guys, not because they, care about peace, but because the United States has bases throughout the region. They have Iran virtually completely surrounded with U.S. bases, which would be very clear targets. It would be easier for Iran to hit those U.S. bases around its borders than it is for them to hit Israel. And they showed yesterday that they can hit Israel quite effectively. So I think this thing, some people say we're heading towards World War III. I think we're already there. The US and NATO are, they've got three fronts going on right now. They've got the Middle East front, and they've got the front with Russia and Ukraine. And now they're trying to open the front with China and Taiwan. There's no way that the United States and even NATO, because NATO was part of the war in Afghanistan, the US and NATO could not beat the Taliban in Afghanistan. How in God's name do they think they can take on Russia, China, and Iran all at the same time? It's total lunacy. But I think it's a sign of complete and utter desperation on the part of the colonial Western diminishing empire. 600 years of colonization of the global South by the US and Europe, and stealing the resources from the global South. And now those days are over. The global South, through organizations like BRICS, are rising, and with the support of China and Russia and Iran and other countries, it's a new world. And the US and NATO, the Western elites, the Western colonists, the Western mobsters, I would call them, are desperate. And they're so far showing that they're going to try to fight their way out of this, at least destroy everything. If they can't have it all, then they seem willing to destroy.
As you point out in your writing and on your site, that the privatization of space is contributing to this your increased military bent that they're on. Could you explain a little bit about how that privatization is starting to enable more war?
First thing that comes to mind is when Obama was president, he signed a new U.S. law violating the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 and the Moon Treaty, which were created at the United Nations. The US signed them, signed the Outer Space Treaty. The US never signed the Moon Treaty. But these treaties say that that space and the planetary bodies are the province of all humankind, and that no country, no corporation, no individual can claim ownership of any of these planetary bodies. Well, Obama signed a law giving US corporations the right to go out and make land claims on various planetary bodies to begin the operation of mining the sky. And so, for some time, all the way back in the 1980s, the United States government has been talking about building a military highway from the Earth through space, connecting to the planetary bodies that they would control, like the front gate of a military base. You know, the US military controls the gate, decides who gets in and who gets out. And their plan today is to control the pathway on and off the planet Earth into space so that these private entities in the United States and their allies, mostly in Europe, can go out and mine the sky and grab the resources for benefit. In addition, the orbits around lower Earth orbit, there are various orbits in space, but the one closest to the Earth is called LEO, lower Earth orbit. And it's becoming increasingly crowded because of the launch, primarily by SpaceX, who's already launched thousands of satellites into space and now has been given permission by the United States government to launch tens of thousands more. And the strategy today by the United States is to fill up lower Earth orbit with as many satellites. They call them dual use, meaning, oh, they're civilian, you know, but yeah, the military can use them too. But in fact, it's all about military control of lower Earth orbit because whoever controls lower Earth orbit has an advantage. They can see the Earth, they can see everything on the Earth, and they can use these satellites again for targeting in wartime. Russia and China are very angry about this, and they say that we're not going to allow you to fill up lower Earth orbit because this would give you a military advantage. And so China is now rushing to itself launch hundreds or even thousands of satellites into space. A whole new area of military conflict is developing. And there's two problems with this crowding in lower Earth orbit. Number one is you start having war with each other, you start blowing up each other's satellites. Or they, because they're so crowded, accidents start to happen. It's like a parking lot at a grocery store. It becomes so crowded that soon cars are kind of bumping into each other. And this could very soon happen in lower Earth orbit. And as a result of that, a NASA scientist has coined a phrase, the Kessler syndrome. When things start crashing into each other, when satellites either get blown up in war or just because of the crowded conditions, you start creating even more space debris, space junk, orbiting lower Earth orbit at high speeds, and you have a cascading collision effect. And when that happens, guess what? Earth goes dark. Because most of what we do here on the Earth, whether it's internet banking, cell phones, air traffic control, cable TV, I mean, you name it, we rely on satellites to run our quote unquote modern life here on the planet. In 1989, I organized a protest at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida opposing the militarization of space. And we had an Apollo astronaut, an early moonwalker, Edgar Mitchell, come and speak. And he says, if we have one war in space, it'll be the one and the only, because we will create so much space debris that we will be entombed to the planet. We won't be able to get a rocket off the Earth through this minefield in lower Earth orbit. And so he warned against this madness that we are seeing continue today.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, Bruce. I mean, could you maybe just keep space for Peace Week? I mean, what exactly is the theme of this year's Keep Space for Peace Week? And we can maybe mention a few of the things that you're doing.
The theme this year is how space technology guides and supports the genocide of Palestine, and I would say now Lebanon as well. So that's our theme. And we're going to have on our website and our my blog is called Organizing Notes. The address of the blog is space, the number four, peace, space for peace, dot blogspot, blogspot.com. spaceforpeace.blogspot.com. You go on there today, you'll see a list of the actions that we know of so far that are happening all over the world. And England, there's quite a few because England is being brought into this program. The United States is trying to get the Allies into the space launch program to help fill up lower Earth orbit, to have more launch sites to attack Russia and China with missiles in the future. So at many bases in England, there's events going to be happening in South Korea. The U.S. is dragging South Korea in for the same reasons to prepare for the attack on China. Here in Maine, Bath Iron Works, where they build these Aegis destroyers that I earlier talked about, will be having protests there. They'll be at the White House. They'll be at the in London. At the Ministry of Defense, there's going to be a protest there. We're going to have a webinar, a space issues webinar on October 13th with various speakers from the Global Network Board of Directors around the world. There's going to be a drone protest for 6 days at Creech Air Force Base in near Las Vegas. Drone warfare is totally reliant on space technology. In South Korea, because it's a growing hotbed for militarization of space, again, under the control of the US, there's going to be a national organizing meeting held in South Korea during just after Space Week in order to put together a national campaign against space technology. So things are really growing. And we're very proud of our members and our board members around the world that are organizing these events.
Okay, thank you very much, Bruce. We'll look forward to the coming week, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Michael. Bye-bye.
You've been speaking with Bruce Gagnon, the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. To get more details, visit space for the numeral for peace.org.
Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and a member of the American Institute of Architects and founder and former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He now leads the charge for a new World Trade Center investigation, along with his courageous wife, Gail, at richardgage911.org. He will join us after a brief break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Here's Richard Gage explaining his view that the attacks by Hamas on Israel nearly a year ago was a false flag, much like 9/11.
9/11 and Gaza both shared the features of false flag operations. What are those? Well, first, they create the original problem. And what are the problems associated with these two events? Well, there's parallel number one. Previously established geostrategic goals coveting the natural resources of the target territory. And parallel number two, a rich history of historic and recent provocations and false flag operations by the United States and by Israel to achieve their respective goals. They deploy politically useful controlled patsies, parallel number three. Parallel number four, they have a triggering event like an innovative attack with dubious origins, a manufactured invasion from foreign operatives. Parallel number five, a catastrophic intelligence failure, which of course Gaza is particularly famous for, along with 9/11 and the stand down, the military stand down, which is parallel six, an obvious uncharacteristic delay in response. Whoops, something happened. We couldn't quite get a handle on this massive overwhelm of our resources. Parallel number seven, of course, is foreknowledge of the attacks, because with engineered events like these, people know about them in advance. Parallel number eight is an interesting one, an uncontrolled delight during the attacks. In both cases, we have Israelis dancing during massive destruction or being under attack. In the case of Gaza, Israelis actually dancing during a rocket attack from Gaza, which is supposed to be a problem they're supposed to be defending against, but they're dancing during this attack. What do they know, in other words? Well, that was all the original problem, but there's a series of parallels associated with the management of the public reaction to the problem, i.e. parallel number nine, government and media propaganda with outrageous slogans in order to manipulate public emotions and deploying crisis actors. Parallel 10, atrocities are alleged to the enemy with the ensuing dehumanization. This is, of course, famous. They said these are animals, you know, in Gaza, yeah. And none of those were actually true. And in the U.S., Guantanamo Bay, they're described as the worst of the worst. You know, that's why they have to be put in these prisons and done extraordinary rendition, et cetera, et cetera. And we can get to these if we have 3 hours, but we're going to try to highlight particularly the first parallel. But anyway, parallel number 11 is the denial of those atrocities by the enemy. Osama bin Laden in the case of 9/11 denying responsibility for the attacks. And of course, the atrocities being denied by Hamas that were alleged to them in the form of severe abuse, rapes, beheading of babies, etc. Parallel 12 is the opposition media and journalists that are targeted. Al Jazeera was targeted in the case of the invasion of Iraq and its attack. And of course, once again, I think 100 journalists have been attacked, killed in following 10/7. So they have the original problem that they create. They manage the public reaction. And then part C is offering the prescribed solution to the problem, which includes several parallels in and of itself, like the military revenge attack, parallel 13, prepared in advance with no investigation. We're going to war. We'll investigate later. We go to war now. And that's, it took
9/11 commission, and took them about 411 days to finally get it going. And it was,
that's it. Yeah. That's what I was looking for. And of course, Netanyahu's saying the same thing, and still no investigation, right? Yeah. Parallel 14, we have the occupation of the territory of the new enemy. This is the land grab. Of course, we invaded Afghanistan and Iraq that we'll talk about. And in the case of 9/11, we'll see the objectives for invading Gaza that pre-existed 10/7 by decades, actually. And so parallel 15 is the widening of the conflict. We're seeing that now with the provocation of Iran by Israel with the assassination of key Hezbollah and Iranian military members, and consummating in the 180 missiles that are rained down last night on Israel. And so we're inevitably going to see an even larger escalation by Israel, because that is the original goal, which we will take a look at in detail. Parallel 16, we have the effecting of regime change of the enemy leadership. That's one of the goals. Of course, Hamas will not be allowed to exist anymore. Well, we've found that Hamas was a creature of Israel and the Mossad, having been formed and funded by them as long ago as 2006, as a foil against the Palestinian Liberation Organization at the time, which was looking for a two-state solution. Parallel 17, they enact a forever war policy, and that's what we're getting now. A year on, the invasion of Gaza is not ending the invasion's small scale at first here with Lebanon, again for the third time invading Lebanon, and then now with the widening and forever war policy that was a Cold War with Iran, that's now, of course, becoming quite hot. Parallel 18, we've got billions flowing to the media, the banking industry, the war industries. So we've got 8 billion, you know, here, 3 billion there, 8 billion, 3 billion every year to Israel God knows when, decades, but now 8 billion and part of a 14 billion plan. And this is, of course, going on in Ukraine too, which is not the subject of our conversation today, but it's never ending. And we have parallel 19, extreme censorship of the public by the government, the mainstream media, and even social media now, whose grip has become quite tenacious with YouTube. I've lost 5 channels myself just trying to talk about the truth about 9/11 YouTube channels. And so that is incredible. And in terms of the depth of censorship the Israelis are putting upon their media and their people, with laws having been put on the books that you can't demoralize the troops with counter arguments to the state narrative, and then draconian policies and surveillance instituted by government. Parallel 20. This creates the surveillance state, particularly in light of 9/11, where all of our emails, our phone calls, our texts are systematically swept up, unconstitutionally stored for use against us in Salt Lake City later. We have parallel 21, malevolent roots that go back more than 250 years, giving rise to these massive problems created by leadership that's been installed under false pretenses in each case. The Project for a New American Century, in the case of recently, just prior to 9/11, the neocon think tank that we're going to talk about. So we find that these false official accounts are rather incredible, like false official accounts. Yet another parallel we haven't even mentioned, but what we show is that the planes and jet fuel could not have caused the Twin Towers to collapse, or Building 7, which wasn't even hit by a plane. We show this again and again, as you and I have discussed over the years, Michael, in our documentary, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. And now with our new series of 30 episodes in the docuseries, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom, which brings all of these specific points of evidence 30 in all, which will each be an episode highlighting all of this evidence. So we won't be going into that today, but no. We know that there's evidence of witnesses, for instance, of explosions at the World Trade Center, almost 200 of them, before the towers collapse. Many of them see flashes of light. So we have evidence like that. We have evidence of molten metal in the pile underneath all three buildings, evidence of molten metal, specifically iron, the byproduct of thermite, elemental iron, in all the World Trade Center dust. And that evidence goes on and on and on and into the 9/11 commission that says they were set up to fail, that there was a decision not to tell the people the truth about what really happened at 9/11. And now jumping to parallel number one, we see clearly that there are previously established and geostrategic goals coveting the natural resources of the target territory. This is fascinating. For instance, relative to 9/11, we have the Project for a New American Century establishing in their paper, America Rebuilds, regional hegemony in the Middle East, a vast increase in the Pentagon budget. But they said, absent a catalyzing and catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor, these goals will take a long time to achieve. And so Bush writes in his diary that night, today we had our new Pearl Harbor. Well, the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, had their own website, which they established prior to 9/11. This group of neocons in this think tank called for a $100 billion increase in the Pentagon budget. And many of them, interestingly, were dual citizens, if not most, Israeli and U.S. citizens. So what loyalty are they bringing when they were brought in by the Bush administration and created that new Pearl Harbor that they were calling for and managed the project 9/11?
Well, I mean, I think our listeners are already familiar, very familiar by now with a lot of the issues around, how they used, that basically the war on Afghanistan and the war on terror generally, it was kind of convenient in terms of getting, having this, it was an established geostrategic goal. I think that maybe we're a little less aware of the role of Israel, because they're going into Gaza. And possibly beyond. Can you spend a little bit more time talking about the angle there in terms of the attack and what they're doing, the problem?
You bet. So one of the interesting, fascinating points is that General Wesley Clark actually admitted on a media interview that their goal was to take out 7 countries in 5 years. And I'm saying this in answer to your question, because these countries that they wanted to take out, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran, are the enemies of Israel. So the foreign policy is quite interconnected. And we have the desire of Israel in particular to take out Iran, right? Which is about to happen. And so we invaded Afghanistan to the northeast and Iraq to the southwest as part of that plan and occupied Afghanistan for 20 years, the longest war in U.S. history. As a part of a goal, what are the inceptions of this goal? Well, let's just look at Palestine and the history. We have from the 14th century to the 20th century, primarily Muslims and Christians occupying this area of the it became the Palestine Mandate when the British took over, but it only had 2% Jewish population. And then the Ottoman Empire falls, and we have, after World War I, this British mandate and a growing desire for Jews to emigrate to the area. And so the father of modern Zionism, Theodor Herzl, from 1860 to 1904, is quoted as saying, now this is the inception of Zionism, at least as it became more publicly known. He says what? We must expropriate gently the private property on the state assigned to us. He's anticipating a state being assigned, right? This is before the Balfour Declaration of 1917. It's the spirit that brought forth that promise of the British to the Jewish country, specifically Rothschild, make a homeland for the Jews. But look what he's saying. We shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border, i.e. into Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, by procuring employment for it in the transit countries, while denying it employment in our country. This is before 1904 that he says this. This statement and many others make it really apparent that the transfer of the Palestinian Arab population, along with the accompanying apartheid policy, seemed to be inherent in Zionism from its inception. So interestingly, the territorial ambitions of the Zionists appear to have exceeded that of Palestine alone. In fact, he says, Herzl again, the area of the Jewish state stretches from the Brook of Egypt, the Nile, to the Euphrates, Iraq, and encompassing a third of Saudi Arabia. This is a goal that wasn't simply stated back then, but has been repeated by modern Jewish leaders, Israeli leaders, since then. And so we have Jewish settlers climbing to about 11% by the time of the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And so the promise was by Rothschild, Lord Walter Lionel, second Baron Rothschild, to bring America in to save England in their losing war with Germany if the British would create a homeland for the Jewish people, which they promised to do here in 1917. And sure enough, Americans were tricked into entering World War II through yet another false flag operation, the sinking of the Lusitania. So we have a set of real problems that ensued, as you can imagine. Avi Schleim of the University of Oxford says, the absurdity of the 1917 Balfour Declaration in denying national rights to the 90% majority at the time, Palestinians, and granting it to the 10% minority, the Jews. So one nation, Britain, says Arthur Kessler, promised the country of another people, the Palestinians, to a third people, the Jews. It's one of the most improbable political documents of all time. And in fact, it's 67 words long, yet it launched what is broadly seen today as the world's most intractable conflict. So recognize that 10-7 did not start on October 7th. The problems associated started way, way back in the inception of Zionism itself. And if we begin to look at what happened with the UN plan, which came along in 1946, and it was a plan, not a legal document, and yet when it came out, it in effect gave half, or promised half, of the country of what became Israel to the Jewish people, and the other half, another state, to the Palestinian people. So they lost like almost half their land right off the bat, right? But since then, we've had the Six-Day War, which Israel confiscated almost 80% of the land. And today, 90 to 95% of the land because of all the settler activity and the ensuing violence that's happened. So the strategic goals of Greater Israel have, in fact, been achieved virtually inside of Israel. But they say, author Israel Shahak of Global Research points out, the Greater Israel constitutes the cornerstone of powerful Zionist factions within the current Netanyahu government, the Likud party, as well as within Israel military and intelligence establishment. So, for instance, the Yinon plan came out in 1982, a continuation of Britain's colonial design in the Middle East, essentially, says Mahdi Nazem Roya. So, and it's an Israeli strategic plan that it does what? It ensures Israeli regional superiority. It insists and stipulates that Israel must reconfigure its geopolitical environment through the balkanization of the surrounding Arab states into smaller and weaker states. This is a plan that has become the guiding document and from which they draw inspiration as well as policy. We've seen those policies carried out with the war, but it didn't with the wars that have happened, especially the current one.
Richard, we're starting to run a little bit short on time. I have one more question I'd like to ask you. You know, maybe you could answer it fairly briefly if you could. But I know that a lot of the perils you mentioned essentially said that basically that the Israelis knew that this was going to happen. We've been through that with the 9/11 stuff. Could you maybe take a couple of the more telling examples of how the Israelis actually knew that the attacks were going to happen and let it happen on purpose?
They had foreknowledge, not just from Egypt, but other foreign countries, intelligence ministries, of a big attack, right? And it's coming. And so Netanyahu was warned personally by one of the major leaders in Egypt. We also have the 40-page document that the New York Times revealed that laid out the exact plan that Hamas and followed later. And Israel had this a year before the plan. Their own border guards were screaming at all of the activity they saw on the wall in the weeks and months prior to 9/11, excuse me, to 10/7. And these attacks were being planned and there were exercises being done attacking the wall itself. And so on the morning of, there's embedded reporters, foreknowledge, embedded with Hamas, who were reporters who had worked with the Reuters, with CNN and AP. And they came in with Hamas and taking all these great pictures, and yet they didn't report anything. This is, of course, incredible body of foreknowledge. And so we also have foreknowledge in terms of the original strategic goal of the natural gas assets just offshore of Gaza that have been reported on Global Research, where there are, in fact, 122 trillion cubic feet of natural gas discovered more than two decades ago and $71 billion in oil. Altogether, about $453 billion in profits. And which the UN says belongs to the Palestinian people because it's right offshore of Gaza. But Israel has claimed these resources, and their energy minister even says this positions Israel as the key global player in energy. We're going to be exporting Israeli natural gas to Europe. Needless to say, this has created quite a stir, but not achieving notoriety or exposure in the mainstream media.
Yeah, for sure. I guess we're just about out of time, but maybe if people want to see the entire, because it's a 3-hour video presentation, I think, going through all 21 parallels, is there a place that people could go on the net to research for you themselves, or maybe just read it out in print?
Yes, it's richardgage911.org. That's richardgage911.org. Look for the Gaza parallels slide at the top, and you'll see a whole 2-hour presentation on this subject. And what's of great interest for everybody is the Ben Gurion Canal, which I want to make sure that people realize is still a plan as an alternative to the Suez Canal, a $55 billion project that will reap Israel abundant profits, and the international investors who are planning on building it. And this is be twice as wide as the Suez, allowing two-way traffic, and twice as deep, allowing aircraft carriers to navigate. It's about 2.5 times longer than the Suez Canal, but it will be the new shipping route for major traffic, competing with China's Belt and Road Initiative. But it has to go around Gaza. And so a more direct route is straight through Gaza, which would reduce the excavation cost by a major factor. And so they have put out a paper in Israeli intelligence ministry, actually, that says, hey, we need to move the people out of Gaza. This paper came out just 7 days after got after 10/7, and it prefers option C, which is to evacuate the Gazan people to the south, to the Sinai. And so all of these factors work together to tell us what's going on and why. Why have they destroyed 70% of the housing? That's genocide by any definition. Murdering 40,000 people, genocide. So why? Because they need to go through Gaza and take that with the canal and take that gas just outside, which the canal is scheduled to be connected up with, to then distribute it through to Cyprus and Greece and Italy and on into Europe via the East Med pipeline. So all these things factor.
Thank you for this teaser, if you will, for your work, and well, we look forward to talking to you again. So take care of yourself.
Thanks so much, Michael. You too.
Richard Gage, AIA, is the San Francisco Bay Area architect, the former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and the founder of RichardGage911.org.
That's it for this week's broadcast. Tune in next week for a review of the U.S. presidential election and what the consequences will be for the nation. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation in the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.